Ladies and gentlemen, this is a special announcement. In this, the 100th episode of the Risky Business Podcast, for 2 years you've listened. Now, I give you the next phase in our evolution. I give you risky.biz. Blogs, 2 podcasts, video, news, and forums. Actually, I think it's pretty good.
Risky business.
Risky business.
Risky business.
Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business number 100, sponsored this week by Tenable Network Security. And it's a big show this week because, as you heard in the intro, in our ridiculous intro, we've actually launched the risky.biz website. That's the domain if you want to check it out, risky.biz. Pretty happy to get that one, actually. It cost me a bit, but there you go. We've got 2 Risky Business podcasts now, this one and the imaginatively titled Risky Business 2, which will feature recorded conference talks and single-shot interviews recorded by myself and other freelance contributors. So go and update your podcatcher or iTunes or whatever it is that you use to get the show. Now, some of you may remember Risky Business number 85, which featured Paul Craig's hilarious talk from KiwiCon. Well, he signed on as a contributor to Risky Business 2, so you'll get to hear him interview people at the zillion conferences he'll be attending this year. So that's definitely something to look forward to. Paul's a very funny guy. We're also launching a video channel. It might take a while to get up and running properly, but in the meantime, I've put up a little video clip of footage that I took at KiwiCon late last year. There's a news and opinion section on risky.biz as well, so you can go and read some of the stories we've already posted. There's a piece by Bogan, the organiser of the Race to Zero competition, which takes place at DEF CON. And we've also got a nice little piece by Declan Ingram about common PCI mistakes, and a genuinely shit-stirring piece by MetalStorm entitled "The InfoSec Industry is a Fraud." So do me a favour, if you like any of the 3 stories that we've got up there, we're posting more, hopefully tomorrow. Please do forward a link to everyone you know. Cheers. I expect we'll be adding around 4 or 5 pieces a week, at least in the early days until we get it cranking properly. Oh, and please go and sign up for an account at risky.biz and post some comments in our new forums. I'm really keen to hear what you guys think about these pieces and the podcast, for that matter. Now, we did screw up one thing on the news site. There's currently no SSL protection on the sign-up page, which is pretty embarrassing for a security site, I will admit. We just forgot. Now, I'll leave it to you to decide if you want to risk the sign-up, or you can wait a week and we should have SSL all working and whatnot, protecting logins and sign-ups. Now, before we get into this week's show properly, I would like to say a massive thank you to Gold from Evolved Development. Now, Gold is actually his real name. That is his legal name. And he built the entire risky.biz site. He's based in New Zealand. And he massively underquoted for the job. But he worked through anyway, and he got it all done. And I'm absolutely stoked with all of the work that he did. And if you have any web development work, then I can thoroughly recommend and endorse him. So you can find his site at evolved.net.nz. So, Gold, mate, if you're listening to this, thank you very, very much for all of your hard work. Onto the show now, and this week we're talking to Chris Weissapel, or Weld, as he's sometimes called. He's an industry stalwart and was the co-founder of The Loft, At Stake, and more recently, Vericode. He's popping in to discuss the rebirth of the legendary Loftcrack software, which was acquired and then discontinued by Symantec a few years ago, back in 2006. He and his buddies are relaunching Loftcrack in a couple of weeks, and he'll be along shortly to talk about that. In this week's sponsor interview, we're talking to Brian Martin, aka Jericho, who works for Tenable Network Security. He's also heavily involved with the Open Security Foundation, and they've been collecting and collating information on data breaches. So we'll be talking to Brian about how data is actually walking out of organizations. What do you need to worry about the most? Your backup tapes, laptops left in taxis, SQL injection bugs. He'll pop by with some answers soon. But first, it's time for a check of this week's news headlines with my very good friend and Melbourne-based Chief Security Officer, Adam Poynton. And Adam, I got to say, we're recording this on a Thursday evening. My shiny new website has been up for about a day. I got a beer in my hand and life's pretty good.
Yep, beer in my hand also. So it's looking good though, well done.
Thank you very much. Now, mate, I suppose we should just kick onto the news now. And interesting little piece from Dark Reading here saying that there's been some Trojans custom written for ATMs, which is, I suppose, a bit of a concern to ATM manufacturers like Diebold, who have been affected by this particular bug.
Yeah, they've had a few problems lately. It looks like a very detailed attack. They even mentioned that the malware used the ATM software APIs. So it's not a run-of-your-mill, you know, shotgun approach malware. It's a nice, you know, focused, targeted attack with some sound knowledge behind it.
So some dudes actually sat down and paid attention to this one, you reckon?
Yeah, they didn't want to screw that one up.
What I don't understand, though, is how you could actually get it onto the ATM in the first place. That would be pretty tricky, because you'd still need, obviously, some sort of attack vector into the ATM.
Yeah, physical attack is what Dark Reading was saying for this one. As far as spreading, I mean, you probably remember from the early 2000s when whatever worm it was went around and cleaned up the one of the Australian banks' ATM networks. So they are on the web, or to a degree, they're on networks. So,
well, I think once you own one, you've probably got a good shot at getting the rest of them. It's some sort of private IP network, but as we know, those things are always connected to general sort of, you know, internet enabled machines somewhere along the road, even though they shouldn't be.
Yeah, they shouldn't be, but the truth is they are at some point or another.
Yay, someone screwed up with a cable. Awesome. God bless DHCP, that's all I got to say. Now, if we turn our attentions to the Northern Territory, we're known for its crocodile attacks and, you know, cyclones and all that sort of good stuff. The bloke, we covered it on the show, I guess, a couple of months ago, a guy who was working for the Northern Territory government in the IT department, basically cracked the shits one day and deleted something like 10,000 accounts. He's been sentenced to 3 years in prison, according to this report that ran on zdnet.com.au.
Yeah, 3 years, that's a decent term. I think it's about equal to the manslaughter term in Australia, isn't it? Yeah, but I guess it's just, you know, insider threat, someone with admin can do bad things, that kind of thing.
Yeah, David Anthony McIntosh, 28, former CSG employee who crashed several government services, including Berrima Prison, irony, Royal Darwin Hospital and the Supreme Court on 5th of May last year. So he deleted 10,000 public servants from the system and, caused a few headaches. No permanent harm, but, yeah, it looks like he's got 3 years. I don't know if that's if any part of that sentence has been suspended, but, he's in a bit of trouble.
Yeah, I wonder if he's going to the prison where he caused the crash.
Yeah. Now, New South Wales, we mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. New South Wales that's a state in Australia where that's the state where Sydney is. The government here was considering passing a law which would allow police to covertly install badware onto people's systems so that they could monitor them and read documents and things like that. Now, that legislation has now gone through.
Yeah, it sounds pretty invasive to me. The FBI tried to do that a couple of years ago, a fair few years ago, and install badware, as you say. But it seems pretty invasive. I'm not sure if the New South Wales police have the ability to do it today. But, giving powers like these to anybody may go pear-shaped.
Yeah, no, I really don't like this at all. I mean, The Australian Federal Police have had covert search powers, and that's the thing that makes it creepy, is that they can put this stuff on your system, monitor all of your stuff, and then they don't have to tell you for like 18 months after they've done it. So that's where it gets a little bit creepy for me. But yeah, I mean, the only thing that gives me solace, I think I mentioned this last week or the week before, is that they're so under-resourced that if they're going to target you, chances are you've done something pretty heinous, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, whether your AV engine will pick it up, you know, their ability seems to yet to be seen, I guess.
Now, this next piece, we won't really dwell on it, but it is kind of an interesting trend in malware, which is they're sort of using geolocation services to tailor malware to the recipient's location.
Yeah. I guess it's similar to, you know, user-focused targeted advertising, but in this case, it's malware.
Yeah, they're using IP address geolocation techniques to figure out what city the recipient lives in and then localizing the fake news to that location. And then if you click on the fake video page, you get a bad codec and blah, 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 blah on your phone.
Yeah, very effective. Like they're using, you know, a bomb has just gone off in your area and things like that. And people are suckers for those sorts of things. So it's probably quite effective.
Well, I remember George Carlin, the comedian, saying, you know, when you when you listen to the news and you go, you know, a bomb went off today and killed 5,000 people. You're like, where? And they say Pakistan. You're like, fuck Pakistan. But if it happened around the corner, you're like, come on, Dave, let's go look at the bodies.
So, I love, you know, Carlin.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it is interesting, isn't it? That, I mean, that joke right there sort of, I mean, the fact that we laugh at that joke sort of proves that there's some validity in this approach.
Definitely.
Yeah, localism rules, mate. There we go. This next piece deals with the WPAD patch. Now, regular listeners to Risky Business would know that last year we really did cover WPAD quite extensively because a researcher in New Zealand named Bo Butler did a fabulous presentation to the KiwiCon conference in New Zealand. About a year and a half ago, actually, he did that. And he had basically registered WPAD.co.nz and got virtually, you know, probably about 50% of the Windows desktop machines in his country trying to pull proxy configuration information from that server just because of a bug in WPAD, which meant he could really man in the middle like half of New Zealand, which was kind of funny. Now, it looks like Microsoft have sort of patched it and sort of haven't. Can you explain what they've actually done, Adam?
I haven't looked into it in detail myself, but funnily enough, a close friend of mine happened to buy one of these WPAD domains a couple of years ago.
Close friend, eh? What was his name?
Oh, I couldn't recall, to be honest.
Okay. But what did he do? He set up, what was it, WPAD.co.in?
I'm not sure if it was IN. It could have been. Mm-hmm. You'd probably have to check, but I think the box is offline at the moment. I think the CPU cooked the day the vulnerability announcement came out. I don't think it was related. I think it was just an overheating issue. But, haven't heard back from him whether the patch that they've put out has been effective, but reading through their advisory, it seems pretty all over the place. They say they fixed it, sort of, finally, not sure. Give the admin the ability to do something, maybe not. So couldn't really tell you.
Well, I think the problem that they had is if they were going to mess with this functionality, it might have screwed up existing WPAD configurations. So there was no way for them to really tell whether a WPAD configuration was actually legitimate or not. And WPAD, of course, is Web Proxy Auto Discovery. If you guys are lost listening to this, I'm sorry, but if we really try to explain the whole issue from scratch, it's just hideously complicated. I think for people who've already been pwned and fed bad configuration information, this patch won't actually do anything. But on the upside, if it's been fed good WPAD Web Proxy Auto Discovery information, it won't screw up that config. So yeah, cuts so both ways, you know?
I'm not really sure how they determine whether it's good or evil WPAD.
But they don't.
Info.
That's the thing. This patch doesn't. It just leaves existing configurations alone, which has actually led some people to criticize them for it.
Functionality over security, I think they were saying.
Yeah, I think that's probably a little bit harsh because I think if they did break a whole bunch of people's, you know, Web Proxy Auto Discovery configs, they would catch hell for it. So it's kind of hard to point at them and say, that's a bad call. But it's a real shame that your friend couldn't actually verify that this patch is out there doing good stuff at the moment.
I must give him a call and see how it's progressing with getting that box back online. I think he lost control of the DNS at some point. It was, I don't know, hosted somewhere randomly or something. But I guess with the WPAD thing, it's always fun to like name your machine WPAD or WWW and then like walk into a corporate that you're security testing, of course, plug in and just see if their Active Directory domain allows DNS unsecure updates. and suddenly www.theirdomain points to your machine. Different issue, kind of related, sort of point that out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's still very handy when you're on the inside of a network. I think that's what you're getting to, right?
Yeah.
Just in brief, the latest Conficker worm. I mean, Conficker has really got away from us. We thought, hey, looks like it's kind of under control. And no, it's connecting to 50,000 different domains. Receiving updated, it's due to do that on April 1 to receive updated copies, possibly other malware. And it's about to go burko. So it looks like the guys or gals who are behind Conficker have definitely, I suppose, tightened their grip on the systems that they've already been able to infect.
Yeah, it's apparently a pretty big network out there. A lot of hosts, kind of unknown still. But I guess we just wait till April Fool's.
Yeah, Storm Mark 2. Next piece, BBC bought a botnet to show the dangers to PCs, and they've caught no end of shit for it. So basically, to demonstrate the threat from botnets, the good old Beeb purchased a network of 22,000 infected computers and used it to spam its own email accounts and for a DDoS test, and then left messages on the hijacked computers that they were infected. So, it's kind of controversial for a media outlet to do it, but I guess it just shows you that it's, you know, it's pretty easy to buy this stuff.
Yeah, it sounds pretty grey area, whether it's legal or not. And I guess that's what all the hoo-ha is about. But if BBC can do it, not discrediting them, they're a fine media organisation. But if they can do it, I guess anybody can.
But don't you remember back in the day when something like this would have just caused an absolute uproar? You know, there was a whole debate about whether or not it would be okay if you had access to, say, a botnet, whether or not executing some code on that machine to remove the infection would be an ethical thing to do. And the consensus 5 years ago was that no way, you wouldn't do that. But then again, these days, it looks like people would sort of be okay with that, don't you think?
It seems that way. I mean, if you're right, if this did happen a couple of years ago, it wouldn't have gone down as nicely as it seems to have. And that was exactly that. You committed a crime if you executed code on another system, whether it was good code, you know, to clean up malware or whatever, or bad code. So that's where the line was drawn a few years ago. But these days, it looks like it's generally accepted going by this.
I think it's a matter of time before we start seeing blog posts from researchers saying, hey, I took control of this section of a botnet and managed to clean all the machines. And I think instead of people going, whoa, you know, you're messing with people's systems, they might actually get a bit of a pat on the back for that. I think that day is coming, you know?
Yeah, I don't think that day is now. Maybe coming. An individual researcher, I don't know, the law may look a little bit darkly upon them, but, you know, BBC, someone who's got a bunch of lawyers, I guess can get away with it.
In this final news piece, Adam, and I wish I had known about this, but there has been a flaw in iTunes, which has allowed people to embed malicious code in podcasts. And if I had have known that, I would have owned all you motherfuckers.
So this wasn't the cause for the delay this week?
Trying to figure out how to get it to trigger.
Yeah.
But Apple on Thursday, according to another piece written by Eleanor Mills, Apple on Thursday released iTunes 8.1, which includes a fix for a vulnerability that could lead to theft of usernames and passwords if a podcast containing malware were subscribed to. So, yeah, I missed my opportunity on
Windows
that.
Windows closed. Yeah. I mean, stealing usernames and passwords, I guess it is of value because people associate them with credit card numbers for, you know, their iPhone purchases and iTunes purchases. So there is value to somebody in that.
I could have bought the complete works of Jimi Hendrix using someone else's iTunes account.
Nice.
Awesome. Okay, Adam, thanks a lot for taking some time out to do the news with us this week, mate.
Cheers, mate.
Adam Poynton on the line from Melbourne there with a look at this week's news headlines. Next up, it's time for a chat with Chris Weissapel, who currently serves as the Chief Technology Officer for Vericode. Prior to co-founding Vericode, Chris was the Vice President of Research and Development at Stake, a security consultancy he also co-founded with other members of the Boston-based Loft crew, who were a fairly well-known bunch of dudes back in the day. At Stake was acquired by Symantec in 2004, so the big yellow box could get its hands on their consulting arm. Now, At Stake was also the owner of the Loftcrack password cracking software, which many listeners, I'm sure, will remember. Some might even use the older versions on various systems. Now, when Symantec acquired At Stake, Loftcrack wound up, of course, with them, but it was fairly quickly discontinued after about 2 years, maybe if that. Now the original team behind Loftcrack have got the software back somehow. They've got the IP back, and they're planning to launch a new version in a few weeks. So Chris Weisapel joined me by phone last week to discuss the new Loftcrack. I started off by asking him whether he thought Symantec's decision to drop Loftcrack was because the company worried about violating export restrictions on cryptographic products.
You know, I think, and we did this at stake too, we wanted to comply with all the export regulations. So we, you know, a lot of the export regulations, it's really opinion of what it is until you sort of get fined or taken to court. So what we did was at stake, we wouldn't sell it to, any of the, banned nations that you can't sell, certain technology too. So we would have our reseller check that list so it wasn't being shipped to any of those countries or even in this country to people that were on the known boogeyman list. There's a list of that you can download, I think, from the State Department on a daily basis that's updated that you're supposed to check against, that you're not supposed to sell certain technologies too. And I think to be completely safe of this export restrictions, we're going to start off by just selling it in the U.S. We're not going to sell to people outside of the U.S.
So Loftcrack was discontinued in 2000 and when was it, 2006?
Yes.
And how the hell did you get it back?
It was discontinued and essentially really didn't have any value at that point to, anyone at Symantec. Really, except for their, consulting organization. Their consulting organization still continued to use it. A lot of people would say it's still the best password cracker out there as far as ease of use and functionality. Of course, there are free ones out there, but if you have it, you like it and you want to keep using it. So one of the things I talked to the consulting group about was, we're going to improve Loftcrack and we're going to add Vista support and 64-bit OS support, which right now, if you try to dump the passwords from Vista, it doesn't work because 64-bit mode is different with the API and the memory model. So one of the things I said I would do is I would license back the new versions to the consulting group. I think they see it as, it will be a benefit to them, and there's really no downside. I mean, it's not going to be associated with Symantec anymore. It's going to be associated with, we're calling it Loft Holding Company that owns it now.
Well, hang on. What you said just there was somewhat telling because you seem to be suggesting that the idea of an association between Loftcrack and Symantec is a problem for that company.
I don't think they ever really liked Loftcrack, to be honest. At one point, Loftcrack was actually on some of the Symantec antivirus lists. And I remember calling them up and saying, hey, wait a second, this is a commercial product that I sell to legitimate customers, take it off the list. And I'm going to have to do that with all the antivirus companies because I know, for instance, Trend Micro, if you're running their antivirus software, it won't let you get even to the loftcrack.com website. So this has just been an ongoing sort of battle for us with the antivirus industry, where they want to take password crackers and make them some sort of malicious contraband.
Well, I tell you what, Chris, if I was running a network, I wouldn't want Loftcrack anywhere near it, personally. So I can kind of understand where they're coming from there. Look, in the time that Loftcrack was off the market, another company, Elcomsoft, a Russian company, have really stepped mm-hmm. into the password auditing game. What is going to be new? What is going to be different about your product that you think you could come back into the market after having abandoned it some years ago and actually claw back some of that market share?
Well, I think the biggest difference with Elcomsoft is we're a U.S.-based company, and I am 100% positive that the United States government and the United States military, which were actually Loftcrack's biggest customers, do not use Elcomsoft products. And they're very interested in getting a U.S. supplier back for password cracking technology. So I think there's some benefit to us just being a U.S. supplier of the technology. But also, secondly, since we left the market, Elcomsoft kind of had it all to themselves, and they've priced themselves out of the market. If you look at the prices, you're paying $1,000 for just to crack something like 100 to 500 accounts, which is really, really expensive. So we don't have any kind of account limits like that on LoftCrack. If you have a 1,000 account network, you can buy our $599 version. If you have a 5,000 account network, you can buy the $599 version. So we think that commercial password crackers should not be, you know, ridiculously priced.
Okay, so you're going to undercut them, basically. Is that correct?
Yeah, I don't think there's any reason for it to be priced that high. As far as features, right away, we just want to get it back on the market and have it support the current operating systems, because basically it hasn't been developed in in 2 or 3 years. So supporting the 64-bit operating systems and the very latest operating systems, Vista, Windows Server 2008, Windows 7, which is in beta, adding that support in. We've updated the Rainbow Table support. There's been some optimization of Rainbow Tables in the last few years that have come out, and we're implementing that. So it's mostly in the plumbing. No whiz bang new features yet, and so we want to get that back on the market as soon as possible. We're working on it diligently right now. It's not available. There is a loftcrack.com website, but it's not available yet.
Is LoftCrack still just an NTLM cracker, or does it do other stuff as well now, like, you know, PDFs, Word documents, other types of Windows passwords, or is it still just like an NTLM cracker?
It does. It's really just Windows and Unix passwords. It's really, we don't want to branch out into the document cracking business. That's not really a password auditing feature, really. So we're going to stick in the password auditing market. And some of the new features that we're thinking about are getting some intelligent, what we call our hybrid cracking. One of the things I've been studying is when people have what they think are password, complexity requirements, they're really just password constraint requirements. They don't guarantee any level of complexity. They're not actually testing the complexity of the password. They're just seeing if it follows certain constraints. And what I mean by this is when it says you need to have a strong password, you need to have at least one capital and at least one symbol or number. And you might think that, what you're doing is you're increasing the key space to such a large extent that you're making it impossible now to crack. Like, for instance, if you had the password microwave, for instance, and then you tried to type that in, and it said, hey, wait a minute, you have to have a capital, and you have to use a number or symbol. Most people will do capital M microwave and put a number or a symbol as the last character. We're going to look at the most popular constraints that people require. NIST puts out a set of constraints. Windows has them built in. Some other platforms have them built in. And then we're going to see what people actually do with those constraints.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, you're really attacking the bugs in the wetware. You're attacking the gray matter in that case, aren't you? I mean, it's the same as pins.
Exactly. There's a usability aspect to those constraints that have to be met. It's not like there's a machine generating a random password with one capital and one symbol, which would actually increase the key space exactly how people think. But that's not the case. The wetware is doing it, as you say, and that will still lead to a quote, complex NTLM password still being crackable very easily.
It's funny, too. There's a guy I know in New Zealand who's running a project called PinPop, which is at pinpop.com, and it's really trying to predict people's, what common PIN numbers are, because people tend to enter them in as patterns and things like that, and consecutive numbers or repeated numbers. So he's really looking at commonality and, what people are most likely to pick as their PINs, which is a fairly interesting project. So I've got to ask too, Chris, what is the relevance these days of Windows password auditing? I mean, I'm not hearing of a lot of attacks. You hear about these big data breaches and you hear about incidents in networks. It's not weak passwords that are necessarily letting these guys in, is it? It's usually sort of exploits, SQL injection, It doesn't seem that weak passwords these days are as big of an issue as they used to be.
Insider attacks, which we almost really never hear about because they're so successful and they're very stealthy and they get in and get out. What insiders do is if they can get access to a machine and they can get admin access on that machine, they will dump the password hashes and they will crack them and they will use those legitimate credentials to worm their way around the system and hopefully to the systems internally, and they will try to, if they get more password hashes, they will crack them. I believe it is still relevant, and if part of your security model is banking on the fact that your passwords can't be cracked, and I think most people's security model is, it's fundamentally broken if they can.
Mm. So when do you plan on launching the new version of Loftcrack?
Well, at the Source Boston conference, we did a presentation outlining the features and prices and the different supported platforms, and I really need to get that up on the loftcrack.com, and that's L0PhDcrack.com website, and I just got back from the Source Boston conference, so I haven't got it up yet.
Okay, so you'll be putting that up at some stage, and when did you say, like, roughly a launch date?
We're targeting three weeks for it to be available. We picked up some beta testers at the conference, and we're beta testing it right now on the different platforms.
Chris Weisapel, thank you very much for taking some time out to speak to Risky Business.
I appreciate talking with you. Thank you very much.
Chris Weisapel on the line from the USA there, rounding out our feature topic for this week. Now, next up, it's time for our sponsor interview, and this week it's with Brian Martin, who works for Tenable Network Security. Tenable has been a sponsor of Risky Business for eons, I guess, now, relative eons. And as a part of the sponsorship deals that we enter into with various vendors, our sponsors get to come onto the show to have a chinwag about whatever happens to be topical. Now, Brian Martin, or Jericho, as he's sometimes called, is a security analyst with Tenable, but he's also one of the guys behind the Open Security Foundation, which runs the datalossdb.org website. And that website catalogues data loss incidents. He was quoted recently in a Wired.com piece that also featured a graph of DataLossDB's information. Now, that graph was a pie chart which broke down incidents by type. So you could tell that, 2% of incidents were a result of lost backup tapes, for example. So I started off by asking Brian, when I got him on the line, whether or not the proportions in the graph seemed about right, or if anything was surprising and sort of threw him.
Actually, to me, I don't think any of them are really surprising as far as how they're being compromised or how the records are being lost. I think that just the obvious surprise is just how often it occurs, especially the more we dig and the more incidents come to light.
So it's not necessarily the proportions or the size of the pie slice that worries you, it's just the size of the pie.
Right, and none of them are surprising. Obviously, some of them are worrisome. The amount of lost media, if you look at the stolen laptops, lost tape, stolen document, USB sticks, etc., those add up to a pretty disturbing amount, and it shows that, no matter how much electronic security we put in place, physical security and just, being mindful of the property you keep, that's still being lost on most.
So tell me about the Open Security Foundation and in particular, its work with data loss.
OSF started about 5 years ago. It was originally created just kind of as a general 501c3 nonprofit to support any security project that we felt needed help or attention. The original project that we did under it was the Open Source Vulnerability Database, and then more recently the data loss section of the attrition.org errata section moved over and became its own project.
And where do you guys actually get your funding from? That's what I'm curious about.
Originally, we actually had next to no funding. It was all volunteer effort done in our spare time. More recently, we've actually had several people volunteer to sponsor the site, and that included financial donations, and we also licensed some of the information for commercial ventures. So if someone's going to look to make money off of something that uses our information, it requires a licensing fee.
Now, have you noticed any recent trends in data loss? Because from what I understand, you're collecting a lot of information about data loss incidents. You're even issuing freedom of information requests to various governments in the United States, basically to get a handle on the size of this problem. What's emerging out of this data?
Several things. Number one is the sheer amount of incidents. You know, obviously we see a lot in the media and what we consider mainstream reports. However, between those and the Freedom of Information Act request, we're actually pretty surprised at just how many incidents there are and how many actually haven't gone reported through mainstream outlets.
So what sort of scale are we talking about here?
Right now it's still very difficult to say. Part of it is because we're still making the Freedom of Information Act request and we're still processing the data that we receive. To give you an idea, a single state, for example, I believe it was either New York or New Jersey, ended up kicking back over 750 documents to us. It's just a lot of information to process.
Mm-hmm. So you were not necessarily expecting that volume of information?
Not quite, no. And part of it is that after we received the first few big ones, we began to realize that if the state has a centralized reporting facility where they say that all the reports must be sent to this office, then those states end up having a lot of information returned. To contrast that, if you look at Colorado, where I'm based, my request came back with only five pieces of information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's a combination of whether the state has mandatory disclosure laws and if it has a central place that the people have to report it.
One thing I do find very interesting about the distribution of incidents, the incidents by type, if you will, is the fact that not many, in fact, the minority of data loss incidents actually revolve around systems being exploited. Most of it is just plain old human stuff-ups. We've got 22% of incidents being traced to stolen laptops, 2% to lost tapes, 2% to stolen documents, 3% by email, which I would imagine is an inadvertent disclosure, lost media.
Correct.
3%, unknown 4%, snail mail 4%, incorrect disposal of a document 5%. So, you know, we've got hack 18%. Does this suggest to you that perhaps people's spending priorities aren't quite right?
That's a real hard one to argue. Yeah, so if you look at the chart, over 50% of the incidents are, as you say, you know, they're more the physical, the lost media, and so if you look at the chart, over 50% of the methods for data loss, they don't revolve around what we consider, you know, intrusions or hostile activity. Most of them are actually inadvertent losses. The question of spending priority, though, is even more complicated because when an employee loses media, they generally know about it fairly quick or even within a day or two, and most of them end up reporting it like they should. However, if information is compromised via a web server or if there's a big intrusion, for example, like Heartland, you know, that information may not come out near as quick. In some cases, the organization may not even know about it.
Mm-hmm.
So to try to use our data to say, well, you should, you know, spend more on USB stick encryption, it isn't really justified. You really need to look at the big picture. And part of that big picture is the one that we're trying to help paint, is that over time we're going to have a lot better idea of how these incidents occur. And then eventually we may be able to start to say, you know, maybe organizations should look at spending more in this area.
Okay. Now, I mean, I know that this data that we've just been discussing is incidents by breach type, not necessarily by the number of records that have been compromised. It's not actually
Correct.
Broken down that way. When you actually do break it down by number of records, does the picture change significantly, or is it approximately the same sort of breakdown?
I don't have the exact numbers handy. It's real easy to say that no one type is really immune to a certain level. That's
so you can lose
that,
just as much through email as you can through a stolen computer.
Exactly.
Okay.
And generally, the incidents revolving where inadvertently emailing something, those tend to be lower. However, we've seen stolen computers with high amounts. We've seen hacks with high amounts. We've seen, you know, lost media, USB sticks, CDs, backup tapes, you name it. So there really isn't a correlation between the incident type in the number of records affected.
Now, one thing I find fascinating about this whole sort of story of your involvement with compiling this vast trove of data loss information is when you started lodging those Freedom of Information requests, you actually wound up having so much data coming back, and you did earlier mention that you were quite surprised by the amount of information that came back. You actually had to go out and outsource some sort of data entry to a team of people in India.
Yes, we tried. And actually what we did first is we made a call to one of our mail lists saying, you know, we need help identifying and matching the records that we're receiving from the states. And we ended up getting a few people that helped occasionally, but it wasn't very much. And fortunately, OSF has a little bit of money saved up. So what we ended up doing is soliciting for bids to outsource the help and try to help match what we call primary sources, which is the documents that we're receiving from the states. And while the initial run was not ideal, we had a few problems with data integrity, and it ended up taking a little too much time to moderate the submissions. We're definitely not discouraged at all, and we're going to be soliciting for a second round of bids to try to get another company and just kind of increase the integrity of the information coming in.
The thing that I found hilarious about that experience is the same people who refused to put up their hands and actually volunteer and do something and help you guys out with data entry were the same people who gave you an absolute public flogging over your decision to outsource the work to India. I could nearly choke on the hypocrisy.
Yeah, we lost some friends through email exchanges after that, because when we made the call for help, it was a little snarky. You know, it was basically, hey, everyone says that this is a great project. Everyone says they want this information. All we're asking for is you to spend 15 or 20 minutes a week. If everyone on the list would do one incident a week, all of the backlog would be done in 10 days. You know, so it's not really that much to ask. And instead, we got less than 5 people out of 2,000 on the list that, you know, tried to help out. And on top of that, we actually had people mail us saying, wow, you know, what a snotty thing to say. You know, if you want help, you shouldn't use that tone. And we're like, well, honestly, we don't care. You know, one way or another, we'll do it. This is a volunteer effort. It's a hobby-run site. And, you know, we don't have to answer to anyone but ourselves. And if you want to take... You know, if you want to take 15 minutes to send us a shitty email that you could have been using to input data, screw you. And that's what we told people.
Yeah, they probably spent more time composing their quips than they would have taken entering the data. Yeah, you're quite right. Now, you mentioned earlier that there are commercial licenses for the information. Who actually does license the data loss info?
We have actually several companies that do. Some of it's in the form of RSS feeds for their commercial web page. Many of them that offer data loss solutions. So they basically take our RSS feed of new incidents, put it up on their page, and use it to help justify their product or to help sell it. Other companies are actually ones that are doing research, but the research isn't going to be public. It's going to be used for marketing or internal literature or something of the like. One of the weak spots that we have right now is that our data set is very U.S.-centric. Most of the events that we have occurred in the United States. One of the big things that we've been pushing for and we're looking for assistance in is getting information from around the world. And that's where one of the big helps of shows like this is that hopefully we can reach out and find people in the other countries that will start sending in information. And for the most part, all we need is one URL, any kind of reference to an event, anything that just kind of points us in the right direction, we can take it from there. So if there's anyone in Australia that can help out, we'd love to have you. And if anyone out there has any idea about Australian laws regarding the equivalent of Freedom of Information Act, we'd love to hear from you as well.
It's called the Freedom of Information Act. I'm not kidding. We've got one here, too.
Mate. Okay. It's not So in that case, you know, knowing more about the steps that it's required to fill it out, does a person have to be a resident? Is there a specific format? Where do they get sent? Anything along those lines, that kind of information would be extremely valuable to us.
Okay. And how do people get in touch with you? Right.
You can email curators@datalossdb.org.
All right. Well, with that... Brian Martin, thanks a lot for your time this week.
Great, thank you.
Brian Martin, checking in from Colorado there with this week's sponsor interview. It's time now for a check of this week's audio mailbag, and we have two comments for this week's show. Well, three if you include the ear-splitting second of 4,000 Hertz someone blasted down the line. I think someone might be trying to blue box my voicemail provider. But I'll tell you what, if you want to own my voicemail box, you can brute force it pretty easily. It's a four-digit PIN, which would take a couple of hours to crack if you had access to enough VoIP lines. But don't do that, okay? Thanks. Anyway, our first caller says Checkpoint Steve McDonald and I may have got a little bit wrong when discussing compliance and multifunction appliances. We'd suggested that some people out there in user land may be tempted to switch on IDS functions on firewalls to get a compliance tick. And here's what our caller had to say.
Hello, this is Jens Harsson calling from Sydney. In regards to episode 99, the sponsor interview with Steve McDonald. Having a firewall running on the same box as an IDS or IPS would, I think, go counter to PCI requirement 2.2.1, which states implement only one primary function per server. I'm obviously not a great expert on PCI, so I'm just wondering whether I'm wrong or whether I'm misunderstanding the PCI requirement. Thanks for another great show. Hope to listen to it next week. Thank you.
I don't know if we were talking specifically about PCI there. But to tell you the truth, I don't really know the standard well enough to comment. I really don't have the foggiest. I was hoping to look it up this week, but of course we've been very busy with the launch of the new website. Now, does anyone know out there if turning an IDS function on a firewall would be enough to tick a box under some compliance regimes? Get back to us. Give us a call on the numbers that I'm going to read out soon and let us know. We also have a call from security researcher Didier Stevens. We'd given Didier a shout-out over his excellent research into the PDF into a PDF exploit, the one that had been going around. Now, he figured out how to exploit the thing through Windows indexing feature, so you wouldn't even need to actually have someone open the file. It'd just have to be on a Windows box and get indexed. So here's what Didier had to say.
Thank you for the shout-out on that podcast. Whiskey Business is one of my favorite podcasts, so keep up the good work and stay funny, Patrick. Cheers.
Thanks, mate. Nice to know we're one of your favorite podcasts. I guess in that vein, you're one of our favorite Belgian security researchers. Just kidding, mate. Congratulations again on the nice work, and thank you for the call. If you'd like to comment on anything you've heard in Risky Business or suggest something you'd like to hear on the show, you can call Sydney 02-8569 1835 or USA toll-free on 877-688-8417. And that's it for this week's show. Taking us out this week is some of the hottest new music I've come across in ages. It's it's from a project called Kutaman, or I don't know how you pronounce that. Kutaman mixes YouTube. So Kutaman mixes YouTube. This guy has basically sampled YouTube clips and used them to make music, and it's really hot stuff. If you Google for music remix YouTube, you'll find it, and it's all available online. It's brilliant. This track is called I Am New. Now, normally I'd say until next week, I've been Patrick Gray, but this week I'll just say that's all, folks, and I'll see you in the risky.biz forums. No, it's something more than this life that I had to achieve. Maybe the sense that I have here was quite more than common. I'm not a rapper, I'm a speaker with a knack for rhyming. With a storytelling gift that lives in fantasy world. Has a sorry wardrobe and is a deck to my girl. I'll have cash, give me so a sliver of game. I'm in the wrong matter of fact, they say I'm insane. Now, is it wrong to really think there's something better than this? I could walk around flossing empty bottles of Chris. I only write with the most of just paying a bill or get a deal writing stuff that I really do feel. I would be a fool to listen to the stuff that they say. Get a whack wife and job and be better off dead. I mean, ever since the cat Fred cut off his dread, it's like I'm wiping off the idiot that's wrote on my head. And everybody talks to me like I'm going on three. But they don't squat and ask me, what do you want to be? And I go bananas, cause I'm without a job. Having credit and bill collectors, I am perfectly dodged. But lately, the world got bit too shady. Little innocent kids up to sweet old ladies. And I'm sitting asking y'all, probably I'm just crazy. Cause my world just gave me a unanimous maybe, 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 maybe.
I'll give you a little part of a song that I'm working on, a bit I'm working on. Here we go. I can tell you wanna know my name. I can tell you wanna be in my world. I can tell you want me for your girl. By the way you're looking at me, I can tell I'm always on your mind. So baby, won't you let me take the time? Tell you that I'm really feeling you. I like the way you're looking at me. I can tell you wanna know my name.